Welcome to Video Store. My name is Sam Mulberry. Today we are talking about the 1955 film Odette. So let's step into Barrett Fisher's Video Store. Barrett, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Barrett, I am so excited to talk about this film this morning. This is I can honestly say this is one of my favorite films of all time. So this is, I'm almost nervous about it. Like, I want to do justice to this movie. So let's start with your history with this film. When did you first encounter this?
Well, it's an interesting story for me, Sam, because in the fall of 2011, I had a fairly serious illness that kept me out of work for a while. And some of my former colleagues in the English department knew that I was a film buff, that I taught film and was interested in foreign film. So they gave me the Criterion box set with three of Dreyer's four sound films, as well as a nice little documentary about Dreyer. So that was the first time I knew, of course, I knew Joan of Arc, but I didn't know Odette at the time, nor Gertrude, which were the other two films in that collection. So that's when I first watched Odette. That would have been 2011.
So had you seen Passion of Joan of Arc?
I had seen Passion of Joan of
Arc.
Yeah,
because one of the things I want to get into at some point today is, I mean, that's the I guess I've seen three Dreyer films, but the two that really jump out to me are Passion of Joan of Arc and this. And honestly, as I was putting my 2022 Sight and Sound ballot together, there was a real fight between those two, because I couldn't justify two Dreyer films, but they both felt like they needed to be there. And it's interesting how different those movies are, but also how similar those movies are. For me, I first watched this a few years ago. This was a product of getting the Criterion Channel. This is one of the first things I watched on there. Because I loved The Passion of Joan of Arc so much. I also remember back when we did a first Reformed, which was probably in our first 15 to 20 movies, reading Paul Schrader talking about First Reformed. And he made an offhanded reference to an Odette ending. Mm. And I was like, oh, then like some reason that stuck out to me, because I was trying to kind of puzzle that out. So I think I knew the end of this movie before I saw it. Did you? I presume you did?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I want to hear about you about that when we get to the ending. I want to hear about what your experiences were, because that's one of the things that I don't think it obviously didn't ruin my take on this film, because this is one of my favorite films. So obviously it landed with me, but I don't know what this movie would be like if I didn't know that that's where it was headed. Like it feels, this movie has a powerful ending to it. Yeah, that's so I can't wait to hear about that. That is really fascinating to me. I love this movie. And I feel like we could talk entirely about this movie in formal terms, or we could talk entirely about this movie in content terms. And I want to try to split the difference here. Formally, this movie is almost like, it's almost like trying to be the exact opposite of Joan of Arc in a lot of ways. So I was looking up some numbers on this because I wanted to try to quantify it. So Joan of Arc is 114 minutes long and has over 1400 cuts in it, 1400, shots, which means that there's the average shot is 6.6 seconds. Mm-hmm. Odette is, 126 minutes and has 114 shots in it, which means the average shot is, 10 times the length of the average shot in Joan of Arc. And in my head, as I was watching Odette, I was like, this feels so different, but is it actually? So I actually watched a good chunk of Joan of Arc again, and just to remember how rapidly that cut from shot to shot to shot. So it's interesting how he's doing something very different, even in the. I mean, Joan of Arc feels like it's not exactly montage, but a lot of that, like it's a lot of putting a lot of individual things next to each other. Where this Dreyer is really interested in staying with a shot for a long time. One of the things I read is that of the 114 shots in this film, half of them are in the first and last scene. So when you get into the middle, those shots last for 5, 6, 7 minutes unbroken, and sometimes contain multiple scenes within a shot. Like you'll have a what you would think of as a complete scene, and then somebody stands up and walks to a different part of the room and another distinct scene happens. And I just find that so fascinating that he, who didn't make a lot of films, makes two very different films formally.
Well, that's an interesting point, Sam, because, you know, if you were going to ask at some point, you know, what makes Dreyer an auteur, you know, what is a distinctively Dreyer film, right? There's a nice little extra on the Criterion Channel. It's about a 30-minute Danish television program about Dreyer. And at one point, he kind of talks through each of his films, and he talks about the specific technique that he was using for that specific film. So it's almost like Dreyer adopts a different technique depending on the content of what he's trying to convey. So, you know, when in Ordet, it's very interesting. He talks about how when he was setting up the kitchen, he talked to the woman who ran the commissary at the studio, and he told her, "Okay, now equip this kitchen as you would if you were going to use it." So she brought all this stuff in. And then he took almost all of it out because he was trying to go for a kind of simplicity about the setting. And so then the technique, one of the techniques that you're talking about is with the camera movement, it's very much like an André Bazin view of the importance of maintaining the integrity of space. And whereas Joan of Arc breaks up space, you know, because in a way, Joan of Arc is not about human space. It's really about divine space. And it's about having this kind of theological argument. And the way Dreyer films that, he really wants to just kind of highlight the combatants and even the ideas. And even though Ardette's full of ideas, it's a very grounded film in terms of the physical reality in which the people live. And there's a great comment about this in an essay on The Current where Chris Fujiwara says, "The smoothness and deliberateness of the camera movements give us a unique sense about the reality of the film's world, the sense that everything is both happening for the first time and happening in eternity." And so I think that's what's going on, the way he holds a lot of those shots and has an otherworldly way of in which the camera kind of glides almost kind of effortlessly, and you suddenly realize, oh, we got from here to there, and I wasn't quite sure how we did that. The other thing I want to add is that this is one of the reasons the length of the shots you just pointed out. It's one of the reasons why Dreyer is often considered one of the fathers of slow cinema. Not that his films are hugely long, not like a Bellatar film being 6.5 hours. But the length of those shots and the way he stays with the shot, that's one of the ways which he has had an influence.
And two things about those longer shots too, like it, you hear that and there's the potential to make this, to think like, oh, is this movie really stagey? Like it feels like I'm just watching a play. And there are moments when if you're not paying attention, you can kind of think that, but then he'll do something with the camera. So for example, like in those shots, a lot of it really is either kind of panning or tracking with a character walking through that room, but you have a pretty strict 180 degree line that it's almost tracking along. But then all of the sudden he will push in and turn and you'll see a little bit more of the room than you thought. You're like, you've convinced yourself, well, this is a set that looks like this. And then he'll turn the camera and you're like, oh wait, there's more there. And he'll break that line that he's established. That stuff gets me excited. Like when it happens a few times in this movie, and it's not a dynamic camera move, you know, like you, but it is this thing that shakes me up a little bit to say like, oh, he is not doing a very basic thing. He's actually saving for this moment. The other thing about those long shots is they're not long shots of stationary characters. As you say, they're moving throughout this relatively big room. And one of the things I was reading about Dreyer is the thing he was really a master of was lighting. So to do a 7-minute shot where characters are moving around, it's so much more complicated because you need to light every place that character's going to be. So they're properly lit the way he wants when they get there. So it is sort of fun. The second time through, I would look at those scenes and I would try to say like, oh, look at how that area nobody's in is lit. Someone's going to go there at some point and be perfectly lit. And if you pay attention, they do. They will all of a sudden walk to this point in the room and you're like, oh, he just walked into this perfect lighting setup for this next thing that he's going to do there. So that just, you know, in some ways that seems like that would take so much more work to do that, but it really is effective because you do feel a more real sense of time and space, as you said, you know, that as you're inhabiting this this home and this family, that it's not like individual scenes, but a scene happens and somebody else walks in and all of a sudden the scene changes because this person has walked in, but it's all unbroken.
I want to make a connection to a couple of other filmmakers that we've watched, a couple of other great auteurs, and how each of them has a particular attitude towards the integrity of space, but they pursue it with very, very different ways. So I'm thinking about Jean Renoir and Deep Focus, and the idea that if it's a Renoir film, you tend to think about rules of the game. You're often pulled back from the characters, but you can see all the way, you know. So Renoir is very interested in kind of the depth of space and the implication that there is space outside the frame that exists. And then I think about Ozu, who of course is paired with or linked by Paul Schrader with Dreyer and Bresson as a transcendental filmmaker. With Ozu, you get the integrity of space without the human beings in it, right? You get those pillow shots and you just get space, and then people move in and out of that space. And then with Dreyer, unlike the other two, as you pointed out, it's a much more dynamic sense of space. It's a living, breathing space because people are moving around in it. The other two, I wouldn't say that Renoir is static, but he's more interested in kind of the totality of space. Dreyer is kind of interested in how people take up space and how they take up space in relation to each other. So as you pointed out, almost all these dialogues involve people walking around, circling around each other, moving back and forth in the room. And so the miracle is he maintains the integrity of that space as they do that.
Well, okay. And so then I want to, without getting into the content of this, just formally, I want to talk about maybe one of the best visual setups of this movie is the ending scenes in the, at the funeral. Because there you're in a different room in this house, which is now flipped. Like the house is very dark, and all of a sudden you're in this gorgeous, super lit up white space. And instead of the camera tracking along, it's now on a swivel, which is essentially Inger's head, right? It's like you get this Inger point of view, and the camera turns this, you know, turns on a swivel as if she's watching the action. So you get more of a subjective shot there, even though it's still shot at a distance. It's not subjectivity by cutting in close to people's faces. Instead, it's subjectivity saying, this is what it would look like to watch the funeral from the point of view of the corpse. And it's like, I think that is such an interesting thing. And then when he breaks that and you get the reverse shot, I think the first time is when the parson is standing behind Inger and praying. That's also a shock moment because he's established a particular visual language for this scene. And then he gives you the reverse.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think is interesting comparing this to Joan of Arc is, and this ties into what we're talking about, is Joan of Arc is almost entirely shot in close-up. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this movie has, other than maybe the final scene where you have Inger and Mikkel embracing, like, I don't think there's a close-up in this movie. Everything is shot at kind of a middle distance so that you're, I feel like you're an observer in a different kind of way than you're an observer in the in Joan of Arc, which is entirely about people's faces. And even when you're not looking at faces, everything seems like it's as close up as you can to an object, to the point where you're even trying to figure out what you're looking at.
There is one important close up, Sam, in the funeral scene, and that is the child's face.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, I think about it a couple times. I think it's both before the miracle, but then most importantly, to me, one of my favorite shots in the film is the child's reaction shot. And she's very solemn, and then this smile spreads over her face. And I think that stands out as a close-up, as you said, because otherwise there's very few. He comes close to a few with Johannes, but otherwise it's really the child.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, another formal element, and this points to something else you said, and I want to bring up another filmmaker that we've talked about. This movie has a really great sound design. And again, that seems very intentional as well. Yeah. And it made me think of when we watched Fritz Lang's M, and this was Lang first going into sound, and he was saying the point of sound is that it can indicate things beyond the frame.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like we spend all this time at Borgen Farm, but we don't really see it as a farm, but we experience it as a farm. I mean, like thinking about how often you will hear the cow or the pig, mm-hmm. or you will hear the car of somebody pulling up, or at Peter's tailor shop, you hear the bell ringing, which is indicating somebody's coming in, you know, so it's telling us things that are happening that we can't see, but may or may not connect to what we're about to see. And then one of my favorite sound pieces in here is in that funeral scene. And I feel like this might be the only time that in the movie, it's this pronounced, is because it's such a quiet scene. As people are walking through that room, and particularly as Mikkel is walking through the room, how loud his footsteps are. And that seems very well observed. If you've ever been in moments like that where people are silent and they're not talking, and it seems like your senses get a little heightened, and you notice like how loud people's footsteps are, where in most of your life you don't hear or think about the sound of footsteps. It's so loud in that scene, and that it seems like that is trying to indicate something as well. You know, that this is a setting that we're sort of familiar with, almost like as a child, you're attuned to those things because this is different than what it normally is.
And other little domestic sounds when they're having the coffee, right? You get the clink of the spoon against the cup as they stir. It all gives you that very strong sense of domestic reality. I would also point out one thing I often have a hard time paying attention to in a film is the soundtrack in terms of the music soundtrack. And the film opens with a lot of orchestral music. And then I think it's the scene towards the end when they're looking for Johannes, which is really interesting stylistically, just because Dreyer does all these wipe transitions. It's really odd. Anyway, if I recall, that's when there's music for that. And I remember thinking, oh, we haven't had music this entire film. I mean, so it's like all of a sudden, it's not exactly a different mode, but it's like, as a result, I found the music much more affecting. It wasn't distracting because I noticed it, but it was part of creating a different kind of mood, because I realized, oh, it's been really very quiet except for those noises you mentioned and the sound of conversation. And now we're kind of shifting to a little bit of a different mode. And it really, I don't know, it helped create a really interesting tonal shift with the music.
Absolutely. So I want to get into the content of this movie a little bit, because again, formally it's super interesting, but what really hits me is also this other stuff. One of the things that I love about this movie, and it really hit home when I watched it this time around, was how family is depicted in this. Because unlike a lot of other dramas, the characters in this film, and particularly the Borgen family, are not extreme characters. And I say that because if you read a brief like paragraph description of this movie, you would think, oh, this is a movie where the father's very religious and the one son has lost his faith and the other son is you know, trying to find a wife, and the other son is this like kind of gone into the deep end religiously, to the point where he thinks he's Jesus. That sounds like this is going to be this extreme movie about faith and atheism and debates like this, and it's like, that is not this movie. It No. sounds like it's going to be that. The setup feels like that. And if Dreyer had wanted it to, I mean, this family could be the Karamazovs, right? You could have Mikkel could be your Ivan character, but he barely talks about his loss of faith. Yeah. Like it's there, and the father sort of laments it, but not in a I'm going to cut you out of the family sort of way. You know, Anders, this is more of a stretch. Anders could be your Dimitri a little bit, and then and then Johannes could be your Alyosha. Like it's set up on paper to be that, and then that's not what this, and I love it. I don't want that movie, and it's not that. And you know, instead, you know, Morten has frustrations with his sons, but again, it's not in a way where it's like this is this, you know, climactic end of the world kind of struggles, but it is, so it's these smaller, you know, I think you use the word grounded struggles, you know, where he's sad that his son is not religious, and he's concerned about Johannes, and he's concerned about maybe that he did something to make Johannes this way. So it's weird to say that this is like one of the most realistic depictions of a family, when at the same time there's a character walking around who claims to be Jesus. Like, it's weird to say that, but it's absolutely true. Like, this feels more real than other things, because I feel like he's going out of his way not to heighten conflict within the family and within a lot of the movie. Like, even Peter and Morton, who have the biggest like flat out debate, it's like even that doesn't feel like it's this, again, this heightened or extreme thing.
Well, I'll suggest another literary parallel, although I'm not going to push it as hard as you push Karamazov, but they almost set it up at the beginning for him to be a King Lear figure. And it's like, it's almost like he's this tyrant, and they have to get him to bless what Anders wants to do. But then the way Inger kind of handles him, it humanizes him, and I think part of what's going on is he and Peter are both, to a certain degree, trapped by their past. In other words, Morton talks at one point about how, it's like there's been these religious wars, and he won. He claimed the farm for the kingdom of God, and whatever theological battle he was trying to win, he regards himself as a victor, and Peter regards himself as somebody whose position has to be staunchly opposed to whatever it is Morton stands for. And even though it would be a great financial and social boon for him to gain the farm through a son-in-law, he's going to resist that temptation. So the two of them have become these old lions locked into this pattern of opposition. And yet at the same time, they're able to sit down and have coffee with each other and basically say in very civil terms, I can't stand you. I really hate you. I can't stand everything you stand for. And except for Morton's brief physical outbreak where he really can't quite control himself, it's almost as though, this may be overstating it to say they're going through the motions, but I think there's a fire that's died and they're both trying to keep it alive.
Well, it's interesting because I think about that scene where they're, I realize I just said they're the people who have the most kind of flat out debate, but if you listen to what they're saying, you're like, I'm not sure what you guys are arguing about. Like there is a sense that Peter's faith is more otherworldly, world to come, and Morton's faith is more focused on this life. But it's like, that's not theology though. Like I was expecting to like have this flat out sense of like, here, this is the big like divisive issue of dogma that's separating them. And like, you can read into it, but what they're saying is they're both kind of saying, well, the problem is your faith makes you miserable and my faith makes me happy. And it's like, well, okay. So I actually think that's one of the good things about this movie is that if you're somebody coming from a religious background, and not even necessarily a Christian background, but just a religious background, you can look at that dispute and be like, I don't need to know the specifics. I get it. I get what is separating these two. And if you're from the outside, you can sort of look at this as a critique of like, religious people get so caught up in their doctrine and dogma that they sound like they're saying the same thing, but somehow they're diametrically opposed. I feel like it works either way. And I like that the movie doesn't get too specific into what is the divisive issue, because like, I end up watching it and thinking, I'm not even sure whose side I'm on in this. If I had to take a side on this religious debate, cause I'm not sure what the playing field is entirely.
Well, in terms of the historical context, right, it's the state church versus the free church. It's the established the established Lutheran church versus what you might want to call a fundamentalist or an evangelical movement. So in American terms, you could say it's mainline versus evangelical or mainline versus fundamentalist. And David French, the New York Times, had an interesting column a few weeks ago trying to talk about fundamentalism and how it's different from other forms of Christianity. And the argument he made is, well, it's basically not really a theological position. It's a psychological position.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we see played out here. I think, in a sense, that's what you're saying. That's what you're really saying, Sam, that they don't really have theological differences. They have psychological, emotional differences, because they both claim to believe the same thing. They're both Christians, right? And yet they say, you don't have faith, and you don't have faith, because they interpret or experience what that faith means differently. But it's very much a family argument in a sense. And so, as you said, you know, even if you're not particularly interested in Christianity, and Dreyer wasn't a particularly religious person. He was just really kind of interested in how people behaved. He was interested in what motivated people. So even if you don't, you know, even if you don't give a tinker's cuss about Christianity, what is engaging is to see how people find grounds of both argument and ultimately grounds of agreement.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to go back to something you said earlier about Morton's response to Anders, right? Again, everything about how this movie on paper would be like, well, he's going to be opposed to the marriage, but I love the way he and Inger interact, because after that, one of the things she says in that is, she says, when he comes back, say congratulations. Now, I love that because I am somebody who is socially awkward and doesn't always know the right thing to say. I actually really appreciate when it's somebody's like, here's what you're supposed to say to this. It's not about, this is not a moment for you to make a statement about something. This is, and if you notice, when Anders comes back, before he says anything else, Morton says congratulations.
Yes.
So it's like, even though he at this point is still deeply opposed to this, he's listening to Inger. I love that. I also love that by the end of Act One, he's already flipped to pro marriage to Anne. So it's, yes, like, if you thought that was going to be the tension of the movie, you know, how do we win our King Lear character? I was like, well, actually, that was resolved super early in the movie, because it's actually going to be this other thing. So I really, really love that. I think, like I said, I think Morton is a really fascinating character in this way. And then I love everything about how he relates to Johannes. Because, I mean, if we really think about, if you had a Johannes in your house, like, it would be really, 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 really hard.
Yes.
And you know, because he's walking in and out of rooms proclaiming everybody's lack of faith, the end of the world. He's even describing, as Inger and the child are dying, he's describing the Grim Reaper coming. And it's like, how heartbreaking would that be? And Morton is so gentle with him. And he's just like, Johannes, just go to bed. Just go to bed. That's great. Like, it's such a wonderful way to respond to him. And then when the parson says, you know, wouldn't he be better off in a home? And Morton's just like, I won't hear of it. Like as long as I am here, Johannes is going to be here. That's something I don't always see. I don't always see depicted in stories and film, but like that kind of response to this person who is having some sort of mental health episode. I don't mean, we can figure out what we think is actually happening with Johannes, but Morton's response is so unexpected and so beautiful in that movie. I think
what's happening to Johannes, we're told in the only potentially funny line of the film,
right,
which is he's read too much Kierkegaard. And one of the commentators I read said that he was quite certain that Dreyer was expecting laughter at that point. There's a little bit of a pause. No, I think part of what's going on with Morton is, I mean, yes, there is in him a kind of fundamental tenderness towards Johannes. And in a way, I mean, it's interesting that I'm going to do a little sidebar here. When, you know, Inger is able to speak to him quite frankly, and she tells him that he knows nothing of love. And I think she's being a little unfair to him, because I think he shows a tremendous amount of love towards Johannes. But I think the other thing that's going on with this, of course, is there's also guilt. And it ties in with one of the themes in the film, and that is, you know, a dual theme of the efficacy of prayer and the nature of faith, that and there's kind of this classic dilemma being set up, that, you know, if your prayers are not answered as you prayed them, it means you don't have enough faith. And so that's, you know, that's to a certain degree where Morton's coming from. Like, I've prayed for Johannes and it hasn't done any good. And therefore, and Inger says, you keep praying, but he says, well, I obviously am not praying with enough faith. And so I think that for both Peter, for both Morton and Peter, guilt over whether or not you have fulfilled your religious obligation is really a strong motivator. So for Morton, it's that I haven't prayed in faith, and Peter ultimately realizing he hasn't really followed the command to love his enemy. So I think they're both motivated in that sense by both their religious belief and their sense of a failure to live up to their to what they believe they should be living up to.
Well, I love Morton's line in particular because what he says is, I prayed to God because I thought it would be worth trying.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, for this movie, is a really important thing, because, like, is that faith or is that like a, well, like, what do we have to lose? Mm-hmm. And he's like, so he says, like, that's as he's blaming himself, that he's positioning his critique of his own faith as like, you know, this is one among many things that it's like, well, this is worth a shot, instead of saying, if I really am this person of faith, really am this person of religious conviction, then why would this not be the first thing that I do and the most important thing that I do? And he's sort of saying it's kind of an afterthought, but also a thing that I did. And I think that hits home to me, because I think what really pounds at me in this movie is this question of like, what do we mean when we say faith? And even as we describe religious things, is like, to what degree do we really mean and really believe these things? And to what degree do we buy into a system that says this, this, and this? And it's like, yes, but like, do I really act like I believe that?
Right.
I'll give you a strange example, from my life where I had a realization about this. And I tell this story in class when I teach about the sacraments. So I grew up Catholic. I remember being an altar boy, and one of the first services that I worked at, afterwards you're cleaning up, and I had the cup and the dish that the hosts and the wine were in, and I went to wash them. So I went to the sink and I was like, you know, and I was about to get ready, and the priest stopped me and was like, well, you can't wash that in the sink, because like, that's the blood of Christ, and then he showed me like, there's a separate receptacle where you do this. And I remember, as like a, I don't know, 8-year-old or whatever I was, being like, oh, I didn't realize we really meant this. And that's been a powerful moment in my life as I've encountered different people of faith and thought about my own faith, is like, do we really mean what we're saying? And mm-hmm. this is why this movie hits home to me, is because that's the central question at the heart of this movie, is do we really right. mean these things that we say, or is this a right. system we have built?
Right. And that is, as you know, that's exactly the Kierkegaardian critique of the Christianity of his day. And Johannes kind of sums that up when he says, people believe in the dead Christ, not the living. And that's, you know, and that's the real challenge he presents. And also, I just remembered, Sam, that towards the end, I can't remember, to be frank, exactly where this comes in. I think it's either right after Inger dies, maybe it's after Inger dies, but Morton says something really interesting. He says, what is madness and what is reason? Which I think might explain part of his response to Johannes. Like, you know, maybe what he's saying is actually makes some kind of sense. And he wants, and there's a part of him, I think, wants to buy into it. So what, yes, he feels guilty that Johannes isn't better, but at the same time, maybe there's a little bit of him that hopes that maybe it's true, that Johannes really is Jesus.
Well, I think about the thing he says when at the very beginning of the movie, when Mikkel is kind of pushing him on Johannes a little bit, and he said, well, didn't you just wanted a parson in the family, and Morton says, well, there are parsons enough already. And then he says like, what we need is somebody to shake up these people, to be the spark that will fire Christianity. And I thought he might be that prophet, which is really ominous when you think, like, did you get what you wanted or what you asked? Did you actually get what you asked for, but you were not prepared for what that meant? And I think about a line that Inger says soon after that, which is, you may not be aware of what your prayers have set in motion. And it's like, okay, like there's this movie's full of lines like that, that when you hear them and you're thinking about the movie as a whole, you're like, that is a hammer blow of a line that gets sort of tossed off by Inger just in this conversation. And then when I rewatched it, I was like, man, she's telling us a lot right there in that moment.
Well, and of course, and that creates the irony that Morton has it exactly backwards, right? That it's not that his prayers haven't been answered; his prayers have been answered.
Exactly,
but as you said, not in the way you expected or the way you wanted. So
yeah, I mean,
he
wanted a prophet in the family, and he got Jesus. Like
that one. Well, you know, I think that in many respects, when we read the Bible and read the prophets, they're very domesticated. I think in reality, they were very strange people who would have been very hard to be around, and I think that's exactly what he got.
Well, okay, and that gets to the other big theme of this movie, which is like, what are the limits that we put on, like we could be people of faith, but like, what are the limits that we put on God? We're like, yes, religion, God, but
yeah.
So this is why I love also the conversation between the parson and the doctor. Because again, in a simple version of this, this is faith versus science, and yeah, we're going to see them argue it, but that's not their conversation. I mean, you get the parson is the one who's saying, well, you know, miracles don't happen anymore because laws of nature. It's like the wrong person saying this, which
yes,
makes it great, right? He's there's a degree of kind of enlightenment modernism to the pastor. And you see the doctor sort of making a joke about, wait, Christ is special circumstances. So it's like, well, do these things happen or not? And I love that. So that conversation becomes far more subtle and interesting, even though the doctor is a man of science and the parson is a man of religion. Like, you're not quite getting the things out of them that you're fully expecting. They're not stand-ins for these polar arguments. Instead, they're these interesting, nuanced people.
Well, it's interesting when the parson says miracles no longer happen. Johannes says, "Thus speaks the church that murdered him," which is a really interesting line. But you know, okay, something very interesting happens with the doctor, and this notion of you know, what's a miracle that breaks the law of nature, and what's something that actually can be explained within the laws of nature. So the doctor says at one point, you know, that a psychic shock will restore him. You know, he doesn't need a miracle. But this is a very interesting scene to me when Johannes is narrating the reappearance of the angel of death. He's doing this at the same moment that the doctor's car is pulling out, right? And he says, "Oh, look!" And I think it's Morton says, "No, those are just the lights in the doctor's car." And he says, and then he says something about, he points something else out. And Morton or somebody says, "No, that's just the sound of the car starting." And so it's almost like Dreher wants to play with that idea, right? That, you know, there are two ways to interpret what's happening. It could be miraculous, or it could have a natural basis. And he's not necessarily saying you have to choose. It could be both and, in a sense.
Right. And that's where he's playing with, like, how do we read Johannes? Is Johannes just putting a religious spin on the natural things, or is Johannes actually able to see something deeper than others can see? What's interesting about this movie is to me is also that I had mentioned when we watched, you know, Black Robe or Silence, that it's like, what really hits me harder than the silence of God is the presence of God.
Yeah.
And how that shapes things up. I mean, I think like about this as a movie about people who are like kind of comfortable with the silence of God. Mm-hmm. I mean, they lament it, but there's a degree to which like the world makes sense to them if God is this thing in the past that they can like look to, but like there's a little bit of sense of like, I mean, especially as we get to the end of this movie, and we should get to this, like there is this sense that like, if we think about the end of this movie, a lot of the miracles at the end of the movie happen while Inger is still dead. The reconciliation between Peter and Morton, that happens before that. You know, Anders is allowed to marry Anne. That happens before that. So it's like, there's this sense of like, yes, miracles happen. Look, these two people who were opposed to each other now sort of embrace, and these families are going to come together, right? They're in, even Johannes is restored.
Yeah.
And there's this sense of like, oh, we're comfortable with that degree of miracle. We can kind of put some limitations on it and say like, okay, this is the degree of like, religion can be transformative in people. Peter can read the Bible about loving your enemy, and this can bring them together. And it's what makes that last scene so great, is because then Johannes comes in and he's like, oh, wait, you guys think that's what a miracle is? You think a miracle is that? Which it is. And it's the miracles they've been talking about. But then he's like, you guys have no idea about the actual power of God. That, you know, this is like, if you had any real faith, you could have asked for something much bigger. You could have asked for Inger back. And to me, that is such a like powerful, convicting moment, because I find myself thinking like, oh, I'm sort of like Morton and Peter and these folks, where it's like, I'm comfortable with a kind of distance from God. I don't know that I want, I mean, we were talking in class yesterday about medieval mystics, and I'm like, I don't know that I want that. I don't know that I want to have, because like, how do I live after that? How do you live after those direct experiences? I think there's this degree of comfort that the people in this movie have with that, whether it's distance or silence. I mean, they lament it, but they also can build a system of life around it. And when the hand of God actually comes in and shakes their world up, I love that that's where the movie ends, because I also think like, man, what does the next day look like? Like, what does Bickle and Inger's marriage look like after the miracle at the end of this movie? Like, I don't know how you live.
Well, I'm going to suggest another way of looking at this, Sam. One of the critics that I read on Dreyer, I think it was David Thompson. He argues that one of the things that Dreyer is trying to get at is, rather than the kind of difference between one set of miracles and another set of miracles, he wanted to argue in a sense for the unity. In other words, rather than saying there's human love and there's God's love, kind of saying these two things actually kind of operate together. That the miracles we see before Inga's resurrection, yes, in one sense they are lesser miracles than bringing somebody back from the dead. But I think I'm going to argue that there's a kind of union of them at the end, when she and Mikkel are back together again, and she says, you know, now life begins for us. And to me, that takes us back to the scene in the kitchen when he kisses her passionately and they say something like, who would have thought we were married for 8 years, because they still have this. So to me, I don't know, I want to argue, I guess, that Dreyer is kind of saying, yeah, there's a sense in which obviously what Johannes is talking about is transcendent, and maybe they're not quite ready for a God who's actually alive. It makes me think of Annie Dilbert's image that when we're in church, we should put on crash helmets because we don't really know what we're invoking. So yeah, there is that sense that they can't dream big enough, or they can't believe enough. But at the same time, I think the way the movie ends kind of tells us, yes, but ultimately, we are human beings living out this life, and the love that we show for each other is one of the ways in which God is manifested in our lives.
I think that's an interesting read. That is not my read of this movie.
That's fine.
I'm somebody who listens to Johannes, I was one of the questions I wanted to ask you, and it's a dumb question, because I want to be like, is this a happy ending? Which of course it's a happy ending. Of course it is. Absolutely happy ending, but all I can think about is like, okay, what do we do now? So the movies that I thought of, this is going to be a weird two movies that I would connect to this moment. It makes me think about a lot of the ways that I feel and think about Stalker, especially Stalker at the end, as he's laying in bed thinking about the things that have happened, and thinking about like, are people ready to really deal with what's in that room, and how he even can't go into that room, right? And I think about Pulp Fiction. I think about Jules, like, I've encountered a miracle. Like I can't be the same now, you know, and then contrasting that with Vincent, who's like, what I saw was not a miracle. There is something that draws me to that kind of story. I think it's because like I said, I think I'm probably so much like the characters in this movie, where I have this kind of comfort with the distance that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that I could handle I don't know that I could handle being Inger or Mikkel or Horton. I definitely couldn't handle being Johannes. But like that's really interesting to me. Like I, you know, I'll be honest, I've never had an experience that where I felt, I mean, I've had it in like the small ways, but not in the ways where, you know, I hear accounts of people talking about things and I'm like, I don't know that I could handle that experience. So this movie shakes me in that way. Like so yes, it's an objectively happy ending, but there's something about it that I am deeply unsettled by, and it causes me to think a lot. And this is to go back to Black Robe, it causes me to think so much more than Black Robe, because Black Robe is almost creating a world where it's like, yeah, I get it, like that's kind of the world that I live in, not in the world, but you know what I'm saying, like the world of distance and silence is easier for me to rationalize. I have, this is something else.
I think it's a good, I mean, it's a good question, Sam. I mean, when I read the Gospels, I often wonder, you know, so Jesus raises these people from the dead, you know, what happens the next day, right? And, you know, and it's almost like, what's worse than God not breaking into your life? What if God breaks into your life once? Now what do? Does that transform the way you relate to the world, or do you spend the rest of your life looking for that to happen again? I don't know. It's hard to say.
Or I mean, the other thing that I worry about is like, do Inger and Mikkel just go, and everybody just kind of, this is this thing that happens that shakes them up for a little bit, and then they just go back to life the way it was, like, because that seems weird. I mean, that's the Jules question of like, I can't just go back to being a hitman now. Like, I felt the touch of God, so I have to change my life.
Yes,
because if I go back and just keep doing what I'm doing, then I can't ignore what happened. At the same time, imagine you're not from this town and you encounter Inger or Mikkel or Morgan or any of these people, and they're telling you this story. You're going to say, You've become Johannes then. They're going to like, no, that didn't happen. Like that doesn't, those things don't happen. Miracles don't. I mean, that the movie's in a world where everybody is saying that, and now all of these people have to encounter it. So, it's the kind of narrative that works on me, because it's, I think that's tougher for me to wrestle with than the other side of it.
You know, the other movie I would connect this with is not a movie that we've watched. So, and I don't know if it's a movie you're familiar with, but the connection will be obvious when I tell you the title. It's a 1980 film with Ellen Burstyn called Resurrection.
No, I haven't heard of this.
And this fits, you should watch this, Sam. This fits perfectly into what you're talking about, because Ellen Burstyn is this character who somehow has gained the ability I think there may be an actual resurrection, but certainly there's healing that goes on. And the way that it alienates her even from other people who say they are believers is why I think about it might be of interest to you. So it's I think at one point it was on the Criterion Channel. I'm not sure it is anymore, but it's one that I would also connect really obviously to this movie.
Absolutely. I mean, there's even a little bit of Fearless or something in this too, where it's like, you know, where when you encounter the divine in that way. So when they made this movie, they shot another ending to this movie, which is really interesting to think about. So apparently there's a version of this that leaves it a lot more ambiguous in terms of, well, was she actually dead, or was in which apparently is closer to the Kaj Monk. So this is based on a play by a pastor named Kaj Monk, I think is how you say his name. So this is a little bit more Dreyer, I think, pushing the like, we're going to clearly position, because I think this is clearly positioned as the dead come back to life. I don't think there's a lot of ambiguity in that, but apparently that was the other version that is more like the play. And apparently they filmed it. But to me, that would strip so much out of this movie. Like, that ambiguity is not interesting to me as much as what this makes you wrestle with. Now, I wonder if there are other people watch this movie and just dismiss this as like, oh, that's kind of corny. Like, everything, all the good things happen at the, like, again, I read this as oddly darker, even though but I'm curious, like, does this movie get read that way as kind of a corny ending?
I haven't seen anybody read it that way. I don't think so. And I would say that I think one of the ways it is important about how he ends it with the miracle is how understated it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I was thinking about, you know, maybe the ending he filmed and didn't use kind of influenced this ending a little bit because, you know, you expect her eyes to, you know, seriously, I think about the Lazarus resurrection and, you know, he kind of comes striding out of the tomb. So you kind of expect her eyes to pop open and she jumps up and all you get are these very, you know, subtle movements in her hands. Right. And then they take the daughter away. That's interesting to me. Mm-hmm. The daughter doesn't get to see the rest of it. And then her eyes are so slow to open. And then you realize, well, if this makes any sense, that's a very realistic resurrection because,
right.
You know, you're coming back from a really long way away in a really, really deep sleep. And so that seems to me to be the way one should actually be resurrected. But I think that helps it to me. It helps it avoid corniness. And I also think that the earlier miracles that you talked about in terms of where you are at emotionally as an audience, I think that helps you prepare for something that doesn't need to be overly dramatic in order to have an effect on you. And I think the fact that Johannes appears to be in his right mind when he comes back in rather than channeling Jesus, I think all of those things to me help make the ending not corny at all, you know, because if like there hadn't been any previous quote miracles, if Johannes was still doing the Jesus voice and then she sprang up, it would be like, yeah, I don't get that. But this is like, if there could be a homely domestic miracle resurrection, mm-hmm. this is it. And it just fits beautifully with the tone of the rest of the film.
See, every odd sentence you're saying perfectly describes this movie. So what was, okay, so when you first saw this and didn't know, because I watched this knowing, oh, she wakes up at the end. I knew before she died, I knew this is a movie where she dies and comes back. Do you remember your responses to this?
I think it was like, really? We're really going to have a resurrection? Because, I mean, everything about this film was so, you might say, realistic. And then the fact that Johannes comes back in his right mind, I was like, yeah, see, so this whole thing was a delusion, and we're going to get a really downbeat ending. She's just going to lie there dead. It's the King Lear ending, right? the daughter is dead. I was just blown away by it, that he actually had, in my view, with the thinking about the time, boy, is that audacious.
Yeah.
I think that's what I liked about it. I think it's just so audacious. And yet at the same time, it worked so well, as we just been discussing.
And I love how life affirming the ending lines are, that you have, I mean, the things that we hear Inger say, you know, at the end is just life, yes, life, yes, life. Which reminds me a little bit of the end of Ulysses, the yes, I said I will, yes, I will, yes, you know, that it's this. Anything else you want to talk about with this movie?
Well, three quick things. One is, I want to get back to this ambiguity about, you know, what's supernatural, what's natural. And I'm going to make a strange connection to spring, summer, fall, winter, when they're looking for Johannes.
Mm.
And Dreyer is quite clear, they have turned this village upside down and they can't find him. And I just find that really interesting. Just like, how did that monk get there without the boat?
I also love how the people you see looking for him are both people you've met in the movie. And then I think just other people, right?
Yeah, like you're seeing. People.
So it's like this whole village is also.
Yeah, that's the implication. The whole village has kind of turned out. And then, not connected at all, but I just want to say that childbirth scene is one of the most difficult for that to watch. And, you know, I don't like medical dramas because I don't like blood and guts. And there's no blood and guts. I honestly turned away from the screen, even though there wasn't anything literally to see. It was the way. Because you know what's going on. And this gets back to what you said earlier about the sound. That scene is made by the sound of her moaning.
Well, do you know, what the origins of that are, right?
No.
So Brigitte Felderspiel really was pregnant, and in the production of this movie had the baby, and they recorded her actual labor sounds.
Oh, wow.
So what you're hearing is actually her in labor having a baby. Like, so she's not acting. That's the actual sounds of
that.
That
is amazing. I did not know that. I'm so glad you brought that up.
The other piece to that is after that scene, one of the darkest lines in this movie in terms of like that really hits me is when Morton asks, "Was it a boy?" And Mikkel says, "Yes, he's in a pail cut in four pieces." And you're just like, that for a movie that doesn't go that dark, that moment is like you're in the depths there. And again, you don't need to see anything else. You don't need to see that operation. Like you said, like a line like that tells you everything about what you were afraid you were just watching.
And there's one more moment in the film. It's dark in kind of a different way. It's a conversation I'm still not quite sure what to make of. And that is Johannes and the daughter arguing the virtues of a live mother versus a dead mother.
Oh, yeah.
And it feels almost emotionally abusive to the child. And at that point, I guess, you know, maybe I'll credit Johannes's madness with insensitivity. But that's a really difficult conversation to listen to.
It makes me wonder when the elder Marin died. Like, when did Johannes lose his mother?
Yeah.
You know, like that. That's what I thought of with that. Is like. Did she die when he was a child, and is this him trying to comfort her? But he's also not him, so it's two other side note pieces that are interesting. In the scenes where you see them riding to Peter's tailor shop and then back, Morton and Anders, you see them in the background, you see a cross up on the hill.
Yes.
And do you know about this?
No.
Okay, so that is the memorial site where the body of Kaj Munk was found.
Oh.
He was in opposition to Nazi collaboration. So that's a marker that's just in the background in it, but it's for him. And then the other piece, and this just warmed my heart because I didn't recognize this, although I looked at these two faces and thought, man, they look familiar.
Oh.
Do you know what movie? Brigitte Felderspiel, who plays Inger, and Preben Lehrdorf-Rye, who plays Johannes. What other movie we've watched that they are both in?
Well, it's going to be a Bergman film. Is it Virgin Spring?
It's not a Bergman film.
It's
Babette's
not.
Feast.
It's, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Brigitte plays one of the two sisters.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So I just was like, man, I've seen these faces before,
oh,
but
wow,
a lot older.
Great.
So,
great.
Babette's Feast is full of people from
from the
Bergman and Dreher movies all been coming back. So that warmed my heart to see that.
That's fantastic.
So we're going to take a little break for a few weeks as we start to move into summer, but what do you have next for us on the docket for when we come back?
Well, I think I want to do one more kind of quasi-religious film to kind of finish out this string. So and a couple month and a half ago or so, we rewatched Groundhog Day, and I was reminded of how much I like Michael Shannon as an actor. So he was in a 2011 film, Take Shelter. And I think in some ways it would be a nice way to kind of wrap up this thought, this kind of examination of belief systems and where is God and how do you get messages from another dimension.
Oh, fantastic. This is a movie I have heard of. I've heard people reference. I don't know anything about it. So that's the best setup for a movie for me is that I know nothing and I'm going to watch it. Barrett, thank you so much for putting this on our slate, for recommending this. Really, this is one of, in my mind, one of the great movies of all time. After having this conversation, like, I feel like I need to go watch Joan of Arc and just say like which movie gets the spot on the 2032 list, because there's going to be a drier spot, but they're so different and I love them both so much. So thank you for recommending this. Thank you for having this conversation. I think it was a really good one. That is all the time that we have, but we'll be back. I'm just going to say in a few weeks, cause I'm not exactly sure between your summer vacations and my summer work, my summer vacations, what it'll be, but we'll be back sometime midsummer to talk about Take Shelter in the video store.